Blog Talk Radio.
Regular guest at 9 o'clock, we have In the Ring with Woody. And at 8:30, we have Gail Corey Thompson, who, as some of you listeners may know, was a passenger on the Audacity of Hope in the flotilla, the failed flotilla that was going to go to Palestine. She's going to tell us about her experience, what happened, and some of the things that are even happening to this day.
Yeah, it should be exciting, so...
And she'll be with us at 8:30. I think we're going to call her at 8:30.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, we have plenty of news for you.
Yeah. And I think I'll start...
That's all over the mainstream media.
Oh, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, forget about it. We only do stuff that... What do we do? Has this been all over the mainstream media?
No, not this one.
Bachman. Michelle Bachman was a tax collector for what she called the most heartless organization that anyone knows of.
Representative Michelle Bachman, a 2012 GOP presidential hopeful, has continually touted her time as a federal tax attorney to bolster her economic credentials. I'm a former federal tax litigation attorney. My husband and I started a successful company. We're business people. We're job creators, Bachman has said. But as National Journal noted, Bachman leaves out a key part of this, her story. Her job was to sue taxpayers on behalf of the United States government. Let's find out a little more about that.
Yeah, she's a wonderful woman.
Yeah. Between trying to change gays to straights in a way that's with she and her husband in a counseling clinic that's not acceptable.
Right.
And now this.
You'll never guess what Michelle Bachman, the rabble-rousing, tax-rivaling, government-bashing idol of American Tea Party movement, used to do for a living. She sued tax scofflaws for the IRS.
As she flexes her credentials as a Republican presidential candidate in a field of former governors and corporate executives, Bachman is more likely to describe herself as a former federal tax litigation attorney, and as she did in her first nationally televised debate, then as a three-term member of Congress. But she rarely, if ever, mentions the one and only employer of her legal services, the U.S. Department of the Treasury. During an interview with the conservative publication Newsmax, Bachman derided the IRS as the most heartless organization that anyone knows of. At other times, she has called the IRS new social welfare agency that will have the right to confiscate our tax refunds. But an Associated Press report during Bachman's 2006 congressional campaign cited Bachman's now-defunct website, www.keepitpositive06.com, where she said she was proud of her work for the Treasury Department. Bachman has also used the IRS as a whipping boy during her crusade against the Affordable Care Act, falsely claiming that the ACA would empower IRS agents to enforce the law. FatCheck.org called this claim flat-out wrong. Bachman is taking a rabidly anti-tax position during the campaign, saying that she favors the highly regressive fair tax, even as she advocates for a tax plan that would raise taxes on low- and middle-income households. And once upon a time, she helped the government agency that she now ceaselessly attacks collect the very taxes she now rails against. What a hypocrite. And that was from Think Progress intern Sarah Bufkin.
Yeah,
she
Think
contributed
Progress
to that.
Is
by Pat Garofalo.
Wow. And what's let's go back.
Good article. But
we already know Bachmann's a hypocrite. We know she's a lunatic. But anyway, CIA organized fake vaccination drive to get Osama bin Laden family's DNA. The CIA organized a fake vaccination program in a town where it believed Osama bin Laden was hiding in an elaborate attempt to obtain DNA from the fugitive al-Qaeda leader's family, a Guardian investigation has found. As part of the extensive preparation for the raid that killed bin Laden in May, CIA agents recruited a senior Pakistani doctor to organize the vaccine drive in Abbottabad, even stating that the project in a poorer part of town...
He was starting the project in a poorer part of town.
...to make it look more authentic, according to Pakistani and U.S. officials and local residents. The doctor, Shakil Afridi, was since been arrested by the Inter Service Intelligence Agency for cooperating with American intelligence agencies.
We're not getting along with...
Pakistan at all. At all.
Let's see.
So let's see if there's any more to this thing here. Relations between Washington and Islamabad. Already severely strained by the bin Laden cooperation, have deteriorated considerably since then. The doctor's arrest has exacerbated these tensions. The U.S. is understood to be concerned for the doctor's safety and is thought to have intervened on his behalf.
The vaccination plan was conceived after American intelligence officers tracked an al-Qaeda courier known as Abu Ahmad al-Kuwaiti to what turned out to be bin Laden's Abbottabad compound last summer. The agency monitored the compound by satellite and surveillance from a local CIA safe house in Abbottabad, but wanted confirmation that bin Laden was there before mounting a risky operation inside another country. DNA from any of the bin Laden children in the compound could be compared with a sample from his sister who died in Boston in 2010 to provide evidence that the family was present. So agents approached Afridi, the health official in charge of Khyber, part of the tribal area that runs along the Afghan border. The doctor went to Abbottabad in March saying he had procured funds to give free vaccinations for hepatitis C. Bypassing the management of Abbottabad Health Services, he paid generous sums to low-ranking local government health workers who took part in the operation without knowing about the connection to bin Laden. Health visitors in the area were among the few people who had gained access to the bin Laden compound in the past, administering polio drops to some of the children. Afridi had posters of the vaccination program put up around Abbottabad, featuring a vaccine made by Amson, a medicine manufactured based on the outskirts of Islamabad. In March, health workers administered the vaccine in poor neighborhoods on the edge of Abbottabad called Nawashir. The hepatitis B vaccine is usually given in three doses, the second a month after the first, but in April, instead of administering the second dose in Nawashir, the doctor returned to Abbottabad and moved the nurses on to Bilal town, the suburb where bin Laden lived. It is not known exactly how the doctor hoped to get DNA from the vaccinations, although a nurse could have been trained to withdraw some blood in the needle after administering the drug. The whole thing was totally irregular, said one Pakistani official. Bilal is a town as well-to-do. Why would you choose a place to give free vaccines, and what is the official surgeon of Khyber doing working in Abbottabad? This goes on anyway.
But, you know, the thing that bothers me so much is that we know bin Laden was dead back in 2001. This was a phony baloney bull crap. It wasn't owned by Obama, by bin Laden. And, you know, the guy in the house wasn't even of any, you know.
And they dropped the guy in the ocean.
Yeah, well, supposedly killed the guy, too, which is, it's a crock, you know. It's a whole crock. All right, so, you know, to go along with this,
that's
the Guardian
ridiculous.
Spokesman said this. I could probably understand part of it, but I don't know.
It's
just a lot of waste of time, you know, to deal with something like this. Sorry we wasted your time, Aaron.
I would like to go to the article on the dollar. It's at the end on the problem that we're having with the dollar and what's going to happen. It's near the end of this page.
Okay.
those photographs.
I'd like to go back to this one, too.
We'll come back to that one, but let's see if we can find it.
My page down goes up. I don't understand that.
Well, you're at the top now.
No, my page down goes up.
Oh.
Doesn't really make much sense to me.
Okay, let's see if we can find this. No. Okay.
Well, what is it?
It's on the dollar. Hope we can find it. I think it was on the first page. I know it was, because it was before.
Well, maybe not, I don't know. Yeah. What was the one? I forgot the article.
It was on the dollar, what's going to happen to the money. What happens when the dollar is smashed and there's no longer currency.
Right, I remember.
I thought it'd be a great one to read.
Yeah, it was. I don't know why. Why? Unless it's maybe on the second page here. Excuse me, folks.
Is that it?
No.
No. I'm sorry, folks, that it's taken. We can't find it.
Well, here's one here. Geithner on the Future of America. Harder than anything you've experienced in your lifetime.
Well, this might be interesting.
I don't know if we can get this one, though.
No?
Nope.
Why is that?
I need to install a flash drive.
Oh, okay.
So screw that. Let's see. Why? It must be on the second page. Hang on, folks.
Yeah, sorry, folks. I wish we had... but we should have bookmarked it. That wasn't smart. Sorry, but it's a really good article that I wanted you to... doing things like subsidizing energy companies and all kinds of things. Really annoying.
Well, now I'm ticked.
And that's a good one to read.
Dollar collapse. Is the single largest event in history.
Let's read that. Let's go over to the article.
Okay.
And then we'll read the one on the guy with the dual citizenship. This is from...
the shtfplan.com,
and it's by Mark Slavo. Yep. The dollar collapse will be the single largest event in human history. This will be the first event that will touch every single living person in the world. All human activity is controlled by money. Our wealth, our work, our food, our government, even our relationships are affected by money. No money in human history has had much reach in both breadth and depth as the dollar. It is a de facto world currency. All currency collapses will pale in comparison to this big one. All of the currency crises have been regional, and there were other currencies for people to grasp onto. This collapse will be global, and it will bring down not only the dollar, but all other fiat currencies. As they are fundamentally no different. The collapse of currencies will lead to the collapse of all paper assets. The repercussions to this will have incredible results worldwide. This time around, it is national and global problems. The global Ponzi scheme has run out of gas as the demographics decline, as cheap abundant oil declines, as hegemonic power declines. This comes at a time when we reach the exponential or collapse phase of our money. The irresistible force paradox says, what happens when an unstoppable force meets an immovable object? We're about to find out when infinite money hits a very finite wall. You can read this.
What is to come is a mathematical certainty, if it cannot be otherwise. The only question is one of timing. Perhaps the final breaking point will come in a few months, and the system will crumble before the end of the year. Or maybe we experience a slow and drawn-out depression over the course of a decade. Whatever the case, we're not going to pretend like we know exactly how and when it will come to pass. What we can surmise, however, are the effects in when the unstoppable force hits an unmovable object. Keep in mind that what we are talking about, the largest financial, economic, and government debt bubble in the history of the world, and it's about to pop. When this happens, we can expect nothing short of unmitigated global pandemonium on a scale never before seen. Take nothing for granted and expect the unexpected. Food shortages, violence, governmental tyranny, and especially wide-scale regional or military, global military conflict. This is the reality of collapse. Yeast. That doesn't sound too promising, does it?
No, that's not a very cheerful...
I wonder if there's more to this thing.
On that video. Oh, here it is. The top five places not to be when the dollar collapses. The dollar collapses will... Okay. Where should we be?
Giant vampires. Thanks to the... thanks to the globalization, giant vampires, squids of Anglo-American Empire, the dollar is the world's currency.
Well, we know that.
Yeah, so the cycle must be cut with when the mathematical inevitable collapse. Israel?
Oh, here. So this leads me to the top five places not to be when the dollar collapses. You don't want to be in Israel. The Anglo-American beachhead in the Middle East was first conceived by the most powerful family in the world, the Rothschilds, in 1917. The Balfour Declaration said that there will be a Zionist Israel years before World War II and the eventual establishment of Israel. Israel has not been a good neighbor to its Muslim nations and has always had the two biggest bullies on the block at its back. When the dollar collapses, the United States will have too much on its plate, both domestically and internationally, to worry about such a non-strategic piece of land. This will leave Israel very weak at a time when tensions will be high. This very thin strip of desert land will not be able to withstand the economic reality of importing its food, fuel, or the political reality of being surrounded by Muslims.
Southern California, a land of fruits and nuts, turns into battlefield Los Angeles. 20 million people packed into an area that has no water, and thus food is not good, to say the least. Throw on top of the huge wealth disparities and the proximity to a narco state, and this does not bode well. We have seen riots for Rodney King. What will happen when the dollar is destroyed and food and fuel stop coming into the area? People will be desperate and go and do crazy things, especially when a huge proportion of its citizens are on antidepressants. Food and fuel cannot get in. What about Zolfot? Zolfot.
I think they must, Zoloft. They must mean Zolfot.
Yeah, at a time when people's worlds
are falling apart. They lack the ability to deal with the new paradigm.
If people come off
these drugs too fast, they suffer psychotic breaks, and you will have thousands of shootings or suicides. England. The land of the Big Brother and former empire of worldwide slave and drug trade will suffer heavily. The stiff upper lip that the British elite ingrained into their sheeple will not work anymore as the British population explodes. The human character will sacrifice and unite for a foreign enemy, but not if the enemy has always been the elite. The Anglo-American Empire may pull up another false flag to distract its population or another Emmanuel Goldstein like in 1984, but I feel this collapse will happen before they pull it off. This will make allies point at the British elite as solely responsible for this catastrophe. We have seen massive riots for soccer matches with hooligans. What will happen when with this island with very little food and fuel gets cut off?
New York City, well, another large urban area living too high on the dollar hog. New York City is the area moved out of.
Is the area I moved out of
in 2008. There is little doubt that all of the wealth in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut is derivative off Wall Street wealth. The savings and investments of the whole nation and much of the world flows to this financial capital. As the world wakes up to the massive financial fraud, this will lead to the destruction of capital like we have never seen before. This will have tremendous effects on the regional economy as people driving in Mercedes suddenly wonder where their next meal is coming from.
Washington, D.C., the political collapse of the federal government will wreak havoc on the hugely inflated local economy as more and more states find it necessary to assert their natural control. The federal government will suddenly lose power and importance as the whole world suffers from a global hurricane, Katrina. The money that they create and spend will become worthless, and the government minions' pensions will evaporate. Millions that once relied on the ability to force others to send their money to them will learn that the real power has always been at the most local level. Massive decentralization will be the answer to globalization gone mad. Local families and communities will forego sending money and power out of their community as they care about the next meal and keeping warm.
You can ignore reality, but you can't ignore the consequences of ignoring reality. To sum up those ideas that have been, to sum up those areas that have lived highest on the hog in the dollar paradigm will most likely be the worst place to live in when the dollar collapses. Many of you will find this article with passing interest, but rest assured this dollar collapse is coming. It's a mathematical inevitability. We will not be as fortunate to muddle through the collapse like we did in 2008 when it was a corporate problem. This time around, it is a national and global problem. The global Ponzi scheme has run out of gas as demographics decline, as cheap abundant oil declines, as hegemonic power declines. This comes at a time when we reach the exponential or collapse phase of our money. The irresistible force paradox says, what happens when an unstoppable force meets an immovable object? We are about to find out when infinite money hits a very finite world.
And they say at the bottom, if you want to become aware and prepared for this collapse, please join the Sons of Liberty Academy. I don't know what that is.
I don't know either.
Should we go there and see?
I don't know. It's probably just a little...
I don't know. You can go to bed if you want to, Frank.
Yeah, Sons of Liberty Academy. When you're aware, you can prepare. Sons of Liberty, okay. Let's go back to our stuff. That was interesting, though.
I want to go back to the dual citizenship. That's right ahead of this one. Just go back
okay.
a little
I
bit.
I wanted to get to, if you don't mind, I wanted to get to some of the, I just wanted to read one on the flotilla.
Oh, okay, because our guest, of the flotilla.
Yeah, we got about 5, 7, or 8 minutes. But I wanted to, excuse me, I'm sorry. Press TV, Greece halts Gaza-bound French, well, we read that before, but activists conducting fly into Israel.
Yeah, that wasn't
This is the one that I wanted to read here.
Why is Greece blocking Gaza?
Gaza. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's important?
Yeah, I think people should know that.
I think it's important to see that.
And Gail will update us on the latest problems that they are having. Hopefully they haven't taken this down.
I just put it up.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. It's connecting.
Computer's a little slow tonight, folks. It's affected by... The connection is timed out. That's weird.
That is bizarre. Well, let's see.
We can't get that article, folks. I don't know why.
Yeah, I got it this afternoon. I don't know why it's not coming in.
Try it one more time. You want to try it one more time?
Yeah.
Sometimes... No.
I wanted to try that one, but it's not coming up, folks. So this
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought we'd read this toward the end of it when we do the let's see. Obama justifies FEMA imprisonment of civilians. That's a YouTube thing.
Mm-hmm.
We can get to that also.
Go back to the site we were on. There's some other things on Gaza on that.
Okay.
And maybe we can find something that is relevant. That's too bad.
Yeah. There's a few articles I wanted to get to tonight on this too, but health issues.
Israeli war planes pound East Gaza.
Yeah.
I can't believe
Let's go to this one. Israeli warplanes pound East Gaza. Israeli warplanes have attacked the eastern Gaza Strip in yet another use of excessive force against the Palestinian residents of a besieged territory. This is as of Sunday. And in an incident, which happened in the early hours of Sunday, Israeli F-16 jets flew over Gaza City, fired a missile at the area of Jebel Reis, east of the city, Zinhawa reports. There were no immediate reports of injuries or damage to property, yet the Israeli military frequently bombs the Gaza Strip, saying the actions are being conducted for defense purposes. However, disproportionate force is always used in violation of international law, and civilians are often killed or injured. Gaza has been blockaded since 2007, which is a situation that has been declined in the standard of living, unprecedented levels of unemployment and unrelenting poverty. After Israel's assault on Gaza Freedom Flotilla in international waters on May 31st, 2010, in which 9 civilians were killed, Tel Aviv slightly eased the land blockade of Gaza, allowing in more consumer goods. However, the naval siege of Gaza Strip remains in place. Exports are banned, and imports of raw material and construction material are restricted. So,
and that's what the people in the flotilla were trying to draw attention to.
Yeah. And let's see if I get any. I had something else on the flotilla that I. Same site as the other one.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe something wrong with the site.
Could be. Hang on a second. I'm going to try to.
We have time for one more short article.
One more short one.
Before we give our guest a call.
Okay, hang on a second. Let's see.
British gas raises gas and electric prices. Sounds like our country.
Yeah. Department of Homeland Security bomb implant threat debunked. New step to an ongoing terror hype. In the last week, Department of Homeland Security and various corporate media outlets have hyped the possibility of Al-Qaeda implanting bombs inside of would-be assassins. You remember they were going to...
Yes, for a new scan machine, I guess.
Yeah. They're going to implant them. But the problem... The main example of this form of terrorism that is being used is, according to multiple news reports, is an absolute lie. Abdullah Hassan al-Asari, an al-Qaeda operative from Yemen, attempted to assassinate the head of Saudi intelligence, Prince bin Nahif, with what was first claimed to be an implanted belly bomb. Multiple reports after the fact confirmed that it was actually sewn into his underwear, and apparently... this fact is unimportant to Department of Homeland Security and this particular ABC News report.
So they just report anything that they want to
get
stronger radiation.
Yeah, just to screw you and to get you through that TSA, you know. Certain facts in the broadcast are easily debunked. The briefing to, I should call them. Well, why don't we do it on this one?
Yeah, we can call. We're going to call our guest. The first one. The first one, sir. The microphone.
No, that's not.
Go back. He has to go back to the other screen. So if you give be a little patient, folks.
Yeah.
And we're going to call Gail to find out just what's going on. Oh, here it is. Dial out. Okay. Click here to dial out.
Yeah.
Enter your guest phone number, and her number is what?
Let me
go and
look
at it now today. Yeah, wait a second. Leo is calling. Eight. That's eight. He's taking a minute to find the numbers here.
Alright, we should have her shortly.
Hello?
Gail Corey Townsend?
Yes.
Hi, Gail.
Hi, Gail. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine.
You're on the air. I'm glad you're fine. You safely got home on July 6th. Is that true?
It's not true. Let's see. Yes, it is true.
Good. We're glad to hear that. We just want to remind the folks that you are a member of the flotilla on the Audacity of Hope. And
great to have you with us.
It's really great to have you, and we're really thrilled that you're back and safe. And I wanted to know how you would. Some people would consider your trip not successful because you didn't get to leave Greece or the port. And how would you characterize your trip, your effort?
Yeah, we actually did get to leave the port. We traveled about maybe 9 knots.
Right, we're having an awful hard time hearing you there, Gail. Just speak into the phone a little louder.
Okay, how's this?
That's a lot better.
Okay. You know, I was saying we actually did get to leave the port on Friday, July 1st. We decided that we had fulfilled all the requirements, and you know, the Greek government kept putting obstacles in front of our way. These sort of bogus claims that let me jump back a minute. The boat was supposed to leave on June. We were supposed to leave for Gaza on June 24th, Friday, June 24th. The day before we were supposed to leave, the Greek government received an anonymous complaint claiming that the boat was not seaworthy. Now, this was an anonymous complaint from someone who had never seen the boat. It later turned out to be a complaint from the Israel Law Center, and this was one of the obstacles that Israel put up in front of us. And so there was this whole snafu. The Greek government was doing Israel's bidding in its effort to stop the flotilla. And so the boat had to be inspected. Well, the Greek government said it had to be inspected. It really didn't have to be inspected because it's registered in Delaware. It's flying a U.S. flag, and it's classified as a pleasure boat. And as such, the Greek government had no authority to inspect it in any way, and yet we went along with that. And allowed the Greek government to inspect it, and then they didn't give us any inspection report. So by Friday, July 1st, we figured, you know, everything was fine. They didn't report any problems, so we took off. And to great jubilation, I might add, as we left the port of Perama, which is next to Piraeus, just south of Athens, And so we got about 10 nautical knots, and then the Greek Coast Guard stopped us, basically, and there was a standoff at sea there between the captain of the Coast Guard boat and the captain of the Audacity of Hope, Captain John Klusmeyer, and they went back and forth for about 2 hours, and then the Greek Coast Guard called in the commandos, who we immediately dubbed as the Ninja Turtles, because they were all dressed in black and had masks on, and they actually looked just like the commandos, the Israeli commandos that boarded the Mavi Marmara last year and assassinated 9 people, including
a
citizen.
That must have been very frightening.
It wasn't that frightening, and I'll tell you why. Although they pointed their machine guns or whatever they were at us for a while, after a little while, they sort of put them down, and they were just standing around, and they really didn't seem to have their hearts in it. And I think that from the experience, that experience, and also the experience with the Coast Guard and the Greek Army people who were guarding us once we were escorted back to port, the Greek people were really supporting us and really support the Palestinian cause and support the people of Gaza. And these military people told us, you know, they were just following orders. And so I never truly felt threatened by them. So anyway, Captain John decided rather than have them board our boat that we would go back to port, and they escorted us back to what we thought was a Greek Coast Guard military base, which we later found out is actually a U.S. military base. Yes. Yes. So that was kind of interesting. So we did leave. We did leave, and we didn't get very far. But we feel that the mission was tremendously successful. Even if we didn't physically get to Gaza, we virtually got to Gaza. And what we did was we raised awareness in the worldwide press and media about the plight of the Palestinians and the plight of Palestinians in Gaza. We had
so you would characterize it as successful. How would you respond to this, Gail? I had a friend say to me that that the flotilla was dead in the water before the people even got to Greece, because they felt that it was that whole group was maybe infiltrated anyway, and that it was sabotaged from the beginning, which is what happens to a lot of activists when they make a stand to anything. They get sabotaged in their attempts to do something. How would you respond to that? Do you believe that could possibly have been true?
I don't know if you're implying like the Israeli, the Mossad or something, was in the group. I don't know if
that someone.
True.
Yes. First of all,
yes.
They chose to leave from Greece, which I subsequently found out and didn't know myself that Greece and Israel were already dancing together after.
After the flotilla, well, even before, or shortly before the flotilla was announced, but definitely afterwards.
Yeah,
and
Netanyahu
made a special trip over there, gave them money, you know, all kinds of special deals were made.
So
then,
many other countries could have been chosen that were friendly
more friendly to
Palestine, but Greece was chosen, and it really wasn't a good choice for a lot of reasons.
Well, you know, I'm wondering if any of those European countries, you know, near the Mediterranean, within sailing distance for us, would have been any better. Because what we found out is that Israel has now outsourced its occupation of Palestine to Europe, and most of the European countries there are willing to do its bidding. And if you're asking, you know, was it dead in the water before we left, I would say that Israel, for the last several months, was threatening to stop the flotilla, and certainly it succeeded in doing that, but it sort of succeeded in such a stupid way because it did the most absurd things. I mean, first, it, you know, we announced what we were doing and what we were going to do, and we announced it to the State Department.
Just excuse me, Gail, just a little bit louder, please.
Yeah. We announced what we were going to do. There was no secret about what we were going to do. We announced it to the State Department, to the White House. We asked for protection, for our government to protect us. The Israeli government knew exactly what we were going to do, but instead of just letting the flotilla go to Gaza, they began this big propaganda campaign. First they said the flotilla was full of Islamic terrorists. Totally not.
Then they said,
you know, it's for national security. Well, we're not armed. We weren't armed. The U.S. boat wasn't taking anything other than 3,000 letters, basically letters of friendship. We had mounted this To Gaza with Love campaign, and we collected 3,000 letters of friendship and solidarity from people all over the United States and children and everything. And that's what we were carrying.
There were several very good interviews that were made. One with Democracy Now that interviewed a bunch of the passengers before they sailed, or before they attempted to sail. But the there was another one with Ray McGovern that came out that was very good as well. Did Ray McGovern wind up staying there or no?
No, he left. Most of us left last Wednesday, last Tuesday.
Good. Oh, okay.
But the,
of the 500, what are these 500 people that are going to fly into Israel?
Well, that's a whole other issue.
That's another issue,
action.
Yeah.
It's a whole other action. It's connected, but it's a separate action. But as far as Democracy Now! Is concerned, they were wonderful. They were one of about 6 or 7 journalists that we had embedded on the U.S. boat to Gaza.
Oh, really?
Once we announced what we were doing, the media began asking to come along, and so we had representatives from CNN, CBS, Al Jazeera, the AP, The Nation, and Democracy Now! On the boat with us. And they were just absolutely wonderful. Oh, and another journalist.
Yeah, but you know what's funny is they never reported anything.
Well, they reported a lot. They may not have reported much here, but
not in the United States.
Democracy Now! Did extensive reports.
Oh, Democracy Now! Did, yeah, but I mean
the
CNN
Nation,
and the ABC and
the
all the other.
The Nation did extensive reporting. AP did extensive reporting. The New York Times did a wonderful article. CNN, not so much. CBS, short things. Al Jazeera covered us extensively. So it depends on where you look.
Yeah, but very, very little in the mainstream here.
So what's happening right now?
Well, the latest thing that happened today was that the Greek government cut off electricity to the boat, which is still impounded in this U.S. military base.
And are there people on the boat?
Yes, there are about 6 people on the boat. Most of them are women over 60. And,
wow.
So they couldn't turn on the air conditioning in the boat. And, you know, very dangerously hot. And for no reason. I mean, you know.
Just for being cruel. That's it.
Yeah, it's arbitrary and capricious kind of, you know.
That's sick.
Now, did you form any bonds with people that you will continue now that you're back?
Oh yeah, the whole group is emailing each other every day like mad, and there's some.
Oh well, that's good.
Yeah,
do you think there'll be another effort, or people talking about other efforts besides the fly-in or other ways?
Oh yeah, absolutely. We're not giving up. I mean, we're not going to give up until Gaza and the rest of Palestine is free. I mean, the real question is, why does the world allow Israel to illegally occupy Palestine and strangulate the people of Gaza by not letting, you know, supplies in and food in. Why does the world allow this to happen? It's totally unreasonable.
We just read an article before you came on about a flyover. They just bombed eastern Gaza again.
Yeah, bombed.
Yeah.
For no reason. Just because.
Because they can. Because the world lets them get away with it. Now,
that's right. Exactly.
The Greek government was obviously doing Israel's bidding, but it's also it's behind it all is the U.S. government.
That's so sad. I was very upset about Hillary Clinton, her statement. It just infuriated me.
Her statement basically giving Israel the green light to attack U.S. citizens. Yes,
that's right.
Yes, I was appalled by her statement representing the U.S., United States people, and she doesn't represent us.
No.
She represents that criminal cartel that's running this country.
Well, also,
she was totally
misinformed when she said, that we shouldn't go into Israeli waters. We had no intention of entering Israeli waters at any point. We planned on sailing from international waters through Gaza's coastal waters to Gaza's port. And our purpose was to visit the people of Gaza and let them know that many Americans do not support
them. Well, these people don't care about truth. They say anything to try to manipulate anyone that's within listening distance. Truth is not relevant to their speeches at all.
No, it is not.
No.
I mean, I don't know if they actually believe what they're saying or if they're just...
Oh, I think they do. They're...
psychopaths.
Yeah.
That's
convincing liars, so they believe what they say.
Yeah, you've been away for a while, but I don't know if you've been following it, but it's like these the biggest crisis now is the debt crisis that we're in, and whether or not they're going to agree to raise the debt ceiling by August 2nd, but nobody is compromising. And the problem is that, you know, nobody has talked at all about cutting the defense budget, all right? Cutting the, getting out of Afghanistan or Iraq. So, and now Libya.
The entire absurdity of this thing is just
beyond the pale, I tell you. It's just.
And Obama is, you know, he'll give in to what the Republicans
want. Yeah, what they want to do is break the back of Social Security, Medicare,
and
Medicaid, all right, and destroy these social programs, and this is what the Democrats are fighting for, but the Republicans right now have the majority, and they're not bending, and they want to give corporate tax cuts and no tax increases and all kinds of crazy stuff.
For billionaires and millionaires because they need their money.
And it all goes back to, you know, a war mentality. You know, this warring, none of this war stuff is off the table. It's all off the table. It's not being negotiated, all right? But, and supporting Israel and its war, ongoing wars, are one of the major pillars of our foreign policy, you know.
As Gail very well knows, the American taxpayer gives billions of dollars to Israel, who in turn gives it all to Congress, so they vote the way they want them to.
Essentially.
And that's the way it is, and that's the way it's been for quite a while.
So you feel positive in some way that you're going to your group is going to continue on in some way to break that blockade.
Yeah, there's no question about it. Whether it's that group or, there's a whole lot of people who are involved in this. I mean, it took a year of planning. And by the way, the majority of the people who planned all this were a group of amazing women. Amazing high-powered women. This was a woman.
I couldn't hear you. A group of what?
Women. Very high-powered, amazing women.
That's wonderful.
Woman-generated project. But it was done with the support of dozens of endorsing organizations and financial support from thousands and thousands of Americans, thousands. And I've got to tell you, you know, the Mavi Marmara, the Turkish boat, didn't take part in the flotilla this year because it was still badly damaged, and also because it was under pressure from Israel and the United States. But listen to this. 400,000 people wanted to be on that boat.
Oh, my God.
400,000?
400,000 people.
You think they would have made more boats, or they would have had more boats available for that kind of...
Really?
Wow.
I mean, but that just goes to show you, from all over the world, that just goes to show you how much support the Palestinian people have. They are absolutely supported by just about every, and I'm not talking about governments, but by the people of countries all over the Middle East, all over Northern Africa. I mean, the Arab Spring countries are, you know, totally in support of Palestine and Palestinian liberation.
Did the Irish ship, ship from Ireland, did that ever, that was sabotaged, correct?
Right, that was in Turkey, I believe.
That was in what?
Turkey.
Oh, it was in Turkey.
Oh, it was in Turkey. Oh, I thought it was in where you were, in Athens.
No, there was another boat. Let's see, it was the Greek. No, it was the...
They cut off the rudder or something. Not the rudder, but the propeller.
Yeah, the shaft to the propeller. It was the same damage in both of the boats. I think the other...
Oh, they do the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, is there any possibility that you guys will get your boat back, or when they impound it, do they just keep it? I don't know how that works.
No, I think the boat will be released. They're negotiating to do that now. In fact, today there was a rumor, or one of the emails said that the Greek government said that we the boat could leave if we get a new crew. You know, needed somebody to drive it out of there, and we need a boat.
Oh, what happened to the
captain?
To the captain? He got arrested.
Captain John. Let's see. When we sailed out on Friday, July 1st, and then we were escorted back, the next day Captain John and our lawyers were to appear in court, and they did appear in court, and they arrested John. They arrested our captain, and he was kept in jail for 4 days, and the first few days under creepy kind of conditions, but then he was moved around a lot. Meanwhile, we made calls to the American Embassy because one of the things that the consular people are obligated to do when American citizens are detained in foreign countries, they are obligated to go and visit them in jail. Oh, now
mm-hmm.
John was arrested on Saturday, and he had a court date on Tuesday. Well, by Tuesday morning, the consulate visited him. Now, granted, it was not Labor Day, but July 4th weekend. But there were two British citizens in the crew, and they called the British Embassy on Saturday because the crew was actually detained on the boat. They were not allowed to leave the boat. And so the two Brits called the British Embassy on Saturday, and the British embassy representatives came down to the boat within half an hour. Our embassy, and there was another American on the crew, and plus Captain John. Our embassy didn't go visit John until Tuesday. So they are totally non-responsive, and American citizens cannot count on their government to protect them when they're traveling in foreign countries. It's really pretty disgusting.
pretty disgusting, all right.
I hope you're writing about that on your blog, Gail, and letting people know that that's the case.
Yeah, I haven't written anything yet because I just jumped back into work, and I've been writing for my job. But hopefully over the weekend I'll have some time.
You must be very tired. I mean, that must have taken I can only imagine the effort that it took and the and the range of emotions you must have felt that whole time you were there.
Well, the most tiring thing was traveling back, because I traveled, I was up for a whole day, for, you know, 24 hours, and I just
wow.
have a hard time, I have a hard time going in and out of time zones. I know some people can do it easily, but it just takes me so long to get back in. I'm almost there. I'm now waking up at 5 in the morning, which is pretty normal.
Well, we're very proud to know you, and we're very pleased that you have these conversations with us that we can share with our listeners, because I think you have a very important message, and we're really glad that you made the effort to be a part of the flotilla. I'm just sorry that you weren't able to complete your mission, but I'm really glad you were able to bring attention to the plight of the Palestinians.
Yeah,
and you've had so many supporters. It's wonderful to hear about that.
And you're an inspiration, not only to us, but I think that millions of people who've been watching this with concern. What is your...
I just want to say, the real inspiration is not... The real inspiration is the Palestinian people, because they are heroic.
Palestinians, yeah.
In my mind, and they are the most resilient, and they're the inspiration for me and for other activists.
Well, you're right about that.
That's true. And how have you heard? How are they holding up? How is the are they? Is anything happening there, or what? Or is it? I mean, are they getting any aid at all? Or, you know, now that they opened up the border
Egypt.
With Egypt,
yeah.
Is there any relief there at all?
The border with Egypt is open sporadically, and it's only open to a limited number of people. It's not a cargo point of
view.
The other thing is, it's not about aid. The Palestinians don't want aid. They want freedom. They want freedom to be able to trade. Because when
right.
they have their freedom and they can trade, they can take care of themselves. They don't want to be a welfare case. They want
That's right.
their freedom. That's the whole point of this. It's not to bring them, even if every single boat in the flotilla was packed with humanitarian aid, it would not make a dent on what is needed in Gaza. They don't want
sure.
humanitarian aid. They want their rights. They want their human rights, their national rights, their right to trade, their right to control their borders, their right to control, you know, who comes in and out of their country, and their right to receive guests in their, you know, in their port, you know, for people to be able to come to their country and be
exactly.
guests in their country.
Exactly.
That's an excellent
right.
point, Gail, and I'm really glad that you made that it's not about aid, it's about being able to be a country like every other country in the world and be able to, like any citizens of any country, get up, go to work, have your children go to school, and just the simple things that we take for granted they aren't able to do.
That's right. Freedom of movement, being able to leave their country and come back to their country. You know, all of these things that are embedded in the Declaration on Human Rights, they don't have any human rights. Because Israel is illegally occupying Gaza and the rest of Palestine. And even though they claim that they're no longer occupying Gaza, that's nonsense. They are. You know, they stop ships from traveling there. Now, the other thing that's really interesting and something that needs more exploration is the fact that there is a huge deposit of gas off the Gaza coast. And rumor has
Oh,
it,
that's
yes,
right.
And rumor
right.
has it that Israel is already tapping into that, and I think that probably plays very largely into the reason why they don't want anybody approaching Gaza by the sea, why they have their naval blockade, because they're illegally stealing, of course, as they always do, more Palestinian resources.
Mm-hmm.
But now, if Gaza was free, if Palestine was free, they could develop that resource. You know,
that's
that
right.
would be one aspect of their trade, and they could develop that and sell gas to Israel. But no, you know, Israel just steals what isn't theirs, land and water, and now the gas. So.
Well, thank you very much, Gail, for being with us tonight, Gail. We really appreciate all of your insights, and I know our listeners are anxious to hear from you, and I hope you'll come back and tell us a little more of what's happening.
Will do. Thanks for having me.
You're bye. Welcome, Gail. Yeah, talk to you real soon.
Thanks much,
okay.
Gail.
Yeah. Bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
And we're about to go to...
Yeah, we're going to have Woody in the ring here in just 1 second.
See if
here
I
we
can
go. I got
find
it right
the music.
This evening.
Oh, it's very good.
It's me just a little louder.
A little louder, though, maybe.
Right into the phone, yeah.
A little louder? How's that?
Perfect.
Yeah, perfect.
Perfect. That's great. Good evening,
good,
sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, DJ 3K, but no show at All-Star Day, NFL news, no HGH for Tiger, Rocket tweets, and a quick look back at the first half of MLB. All right, let's get down to it. On Saturday, Derek Jeter had his 3,000th career Major League Baseball hit. Now, he's joined 27 other men in the game with names alike of Pete Rose, Ty Cobb, Hank Aaron, Stan Musial, Willie Mays, Eddie Murray, Cal Ripken, George Brett, Dave Winfield, Roberto Clemente, just to name a few. So, you know, those guys, they're all just MLB greats. So he's definitely joined, you know, he's proved himself to be an upper echelon player of the game. 3,000 hits is quite a milestone. He also had quite a day on Saturday. He went 5-for-5, which is really unheard of. But that's typical Jeter. You know, he hasn't had that great of a season. Didn't have that great of a season last year either. But when it comes down to it, when money is on the wood, as they say, the guy performs. And that's what you got to love about Jeter. You know, when the game's on the line, even though he's still not hitting that great, you kind of don't have fear when he's got the bat in his hand, or even to make an average play at shortstop to make it happen. So congratulations to Derek Jeter. A great moment for him. He's the first Yankee to do it, so a great moment for the Yankees, which is fantastic. But there's a little bit of a cloud over his head. He decided not to go to the All-Star game. Now, I find it kind of amusing when you have a lot of these ex-players who have now turned into broadcasters and experts, what have you, you know, and they all want to have their little say. And, you know, some have taken his back and some have said, you know, he should be there and so on and so forth. And, you know, according to Derek Jeter, you know, he wants to rest that calf strain that he had, and he probably also needs a mental break as well, and who can blame the guy? You know, you got to remember, this is a guy who's done everything right from day one. I mean, frankly, I think the guy deserves a break. He doesn't want to go to the All-Star game. He wants to take a couple days off and get his head together and maybe let that leg heal up a little bit more. Then, by all means, let him do so. Who cares if he's not at the All-Star game? This whole All-Star game business is bullshit as it is anyway. For one, the winner of this game gets home field advantage. It's just absolutely stupid. This one game is absolutely ridiculous. I frankly would rather watch the NBA All-Star game where all the All-Stars actually play. Jeter may be setting a trend here where guys opt out instead of playing. The MLB has even instituted the rule of if you pitch on Sunday, you cannot play in the All-Star game. So, you know, frontline pitchers, they don't get used, and that doesn't affect their teams later on down the line. So we'll see. But I just found it kind of interesting that also some players chose not to take us back. One former Yankee, although he was only a Yankee for a year, Lance Berkman, said a few disparaging remarks. And a New York Met, Carlos Beltran, said a few disparaging remarks as well. Who really cares what the hell they have to say? Beltran may not be a Met for much longer, and it may be worth taking out of context. Who knows? But as I said, you know, Jeter has done everything right on the field as well as off the field, and he certainly deserves to take a couple days off for himself if he wants to. Commissioner Bud Selig took his back as well, and a few other major you know, players in the game have also said, you know, kind of things about Jeter wanting to take time off. So as I said, you know, congratulations on the 3,000 hits, and you want to take time off for the All-Star game, go ahead, Derek. You've earned it. Moving on. Little NFL news. The heavyweights in NFL labor talks will resume face-to-face negotiations tomorrow in Manhattan with a new issue at the forefront of the standoff, a proposed rookie wage scale. I talked about this last week. The owners are hoping to have a settlement that would end the lockout by July 21st when they have scheduled to have a meeting in Atlanta. But the prospects of that are looking more remote because the players are digging in against the rookie proposal. According to an industry source, the players are upset because the owners are demanding the right to sign first-round picks for as long as 5 years while imposing dramatic cuts on the salary package available to those rookies. The source said the owners want to limit the package to as little as $25 million over 5 years for the top pick. In contrast to that, Sam Bradford, the number one overall pick in 2010, doubled that in signing bonus alone. The proposed rookie wage scale is unacceptable to the players, and it's causing union chief Damore Smith and players' negotiating committee to stand firm amid several leaks, apparently from the owners, indicating the sides were close to an agreement that would save the entire 2011 season as scheduled. Now, having not met since Friday, Smith and players are expected to get together tomorrow again. The NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell and a group of owners that includes Giants owner John Mara talks yesterday and today are between attorneys and staff only. The players are accusing the owners of leaking optimistic dates as a way of to heighten expectations among the fans and put pressure on the decertified union to accept a less than optimum deal. On the other hand, the sides are closer to a deal than they have been throughout the four-month ordeal, now that a general agreement on the primary issue, how to split the league's annual revenue, appears to have been reached. Under that agreement, the players would lower their split from 48% to 48% from a roughly 53%. In return for the expectation, league revenues will continue to grow exponentially over the course of the expected 7 to 10 year collective agreement. As I've said before, I take the side of the players here. True, it is millionaires against billionaires, and it's hard to take anybody's side. However, a player's time in the league does not last all that long. Not everyone is Peyton Manning, Hines Ward, or whoever you like that's been in the league forever. It's just that's not the average NFL player. Your lifespan in the NFL does not last that long. So while you're there, you better be able to get every dollar that you can, and when you're done, you better be able to be taken care of medically as well because your body is really banged up. The owners, however, own their team for as long as they want to own it, so they just keep playing with their pieces. So you got to kind of take the player's side on this, you know. And also, you know, in battling against the owners, you got to remember you're kind of playing on the owner's field. The owners are roughly 50 to 60 year old businessmen who excel in negotiations and moving pieces across the board and everything else. Whereas they have the players. You know, what do they excel in? They excel in, you know, doing stuff on the field. So it's a, you know, totally different ballgame for them to be able to bargain with these guys and everything else. And I think the owners are trying to make the players blink. Because what happens is the players are used to a certain kind of lifestyle. They buy these big houses. They buy these cars and everything else. And then, oops, hey, you got to pay taxes on the houses. And you're used to a certain lifestyle. All of a sudden, you're not getting paychecks, and you're like, oh, man, what am I going to do? Well, what am I going to do? You might just blink, and you might take an agreement that probably wouldn't be behoove you. So that's what the owners are trying to do. They're trying to get the players to blink. You know, they're writing out information. They're doing this. They're doing that. You know, it's tactical stuff that smart businessmen do. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens. I hope the players get what they want with this rookie stuff, and we'll just have to wait and see. Moving on to a little bit more NFL news. Adam Pac-Man Jones might face up to a year in jail in Nevada for violating probation, a stay-out-of-trouble order following his weekend arrest in Cincinnati, according to the top prosecutor in Las Vegas. Clark County District Attorney David Roger said before he takes the case to a Nevada judge, he'll review police accounts of the arrest of the 27-year-old Bengals quarterback on resisting arrest and misdemeanor disorderly conduct charges at an Ohio bar. Jones was sentenced to 1 year of probation in February for his role in a 2007 Las Vegas strip club melee that left three people shot. Beautiful, classy guy. Trouble seems to surround Bengals players, whether current or past, because in Bakersfield, California, former Bengals running back David Lee Deacon Turner was shot and killed Sunday in front of a convenience store after he allegedly hit a police officer with a bag holding two cans of beer. I hope at least it was good beer. Court records show an arrest history stretching back to 1986 for the former running back and kick return specialist. The most recent on June 17th was for driving while his license was revoked because of conviction for driving under the influence in 1979. Turner tied for the league in kick returns with 55. The same year, he was second in rushing yards with 1,149. As I said, trouble always seems to follow Bengals players. They're always getting jammed up. It's just weird. I don't know whether it's the culture of the team, the locker room, the city. I just don't get it. Dudes from the Bengals are always getting pinched. It's crazy. Or something bad happens to them. I think last year or the year before, there was a Bengals player in the back of a pickup truck. He was fighting with his old lady. She, like, took off, he fell out of the truck and died or something. I mean, it's just one thing after another with this team. It's just really horrendous.
Remember that.
Moving on. An attorney for chief witness in the Anthony Galea case, a case that I have spoken about many times on this show and on others, said that one of the controversial Toronto physician's most famous clients, Tiger Woods, never received performance-enhancing drugs while a patient of Galea. Rod Personius, who represents Galea's former assistant, Mary Ann Catalano, told the Daily News yesterday, "I tell you categorically that Tiger did not receive either banned or performance-enhancing drugs when treating Dr. Galea." Now, the suggestion in the media was, you know, speculated that Woods did receive performance-enhancing drugs from Galea. Well, perhaps understandable, given the vagueness, you know, the current availability of information, was kind of, you know, irresponsible and unfair. Also, other clients of Galea, Alex Rodriguez of the New York Yankees, Jose Reyes, and Carlos Beltran of the New York Mets. Now, Galea, he pled guilty in Buffalo federal court to bringing misbranded and unapproved drugs into the U.S. The plea deal came almost 2 years after Catalano was stopped by authorities at Peace Bridge border crossing in Buffalo. Border agents found HGH, medical equipment, and other things in her car. The incident kicked off an investigation of Galea in two countries. Nice. The Canadian investigation of Galea is ongoing. Catalano pleaded guilty last year to making false statements to authorities and will be sentenced later this month, probably to no jail time because she ratted on Galea. Now, although Woods is publicly denied using performance-enhancing drugs, suspicions have swirled because of his link to Galea. Woods received that plasma spin treatment, and I think that Alex Rodriguez received too, where they, you know, they spin the blood plasma in this like machine, and then they like re-inject it because it has more oxygen or something like that. I mean, I'm no doctor, but whatever. It's kind of a little bit of a a weirdo treatment, and, you know, guys that get it, though, do swear by it. So, hey, I mean, this guy here says that Woods didn't get any performance-enhancing drugs. He's an attorney. I mean, I'll take him at his word. I, for one, definitely bought into the fact that Tiger got himself some HGH. But, you know, I guess he didn't. So, hey, good for Tiger. All right. Moving on. To a guy that I've talked about on oh so many occasions because he's just so much fun, Roger Clemens. All right, this is a good one. Roger Clemens' relatives have been burning up the internet to defend his honor and attack his many critics. And their tweets and blogs might just land the rocket in a little bit of hot water with the judge. Now, as you may or may not recall, if you listen to anything that I say, the judge issued a gag order last year in this federal perjury case. According to some attorneys, they're violating this gag order if they're doing it on his behest or possibly even if they're not. They're circumventing the order, especially during jury selection. It's the whole point of the gag order. I would point out to the judge and tell him to stop it immediately. This is according to some Yahoo lawyer. Janet Johnson, one of Clemens' fiercely loyal sisters, has taken to Twitter to defend the legendary pitcher, launching attacks on government witnesses and critiquing the media's coverage of Clemens' perjury trial. One jury began to take shape yesterday. Last week, Johnson wrote that Brian McNamee, the prosecution's star witness, lied over and over again in an interview with congressional investigators. She has also recently posted tweets claiming Jose Canseco is off the deep end, you know, which is probably true. Canseco is a bit of a whack job. And that a seasoned reporter covering the case is re-spouting lies. Another one of Johnson's tweets suggested that former Yankee Andy Pettit, who was expected to testify against his former teammate, was only seemingly trustworthy. Oh, God, this stuff is beautiful. You can't make this kind of stuff up. Was only seemingly trustworthy because his dad used steroids. Apparently, Tom Pettit purchased human growth hormone from Texas gym owner Kelly Blair in 2004. Johnson's daughter, meanwhile, has commented on the, you know, on the case on her blog the night before jury selection began. Kirby Johnson took a thinly veiled swipe at McNamee, who claims he injected Clemens with steroids and HGH over a number of years. According to the girl, she said, if a drug dealer gets in the media and makes claims against another person, people listen to this person as if they were reading the gospel, when the fact is that the person is a drug dealer. She wrote July 5th, they are just the same as the schmuck in the alleyway, but the media blowing them into a larger-than-life authority figure of sorts. That may be true, but when this drug dealer is the guy that was injecting Clemens, you know, with HGH and whatever else he was getting, I mean, you kind of got to take the guy's word, especially when he's got syringes, used syringes, which I'm sure have Clemens' DNA all over them. I don't know. This might be a tough case to prove. I don't know. At least two of the 7-time Cy Young Award winner's sons maintain a Twitter account. One of them, Casey, seemed to be expressing the family's unity. He wrote, "The Lord knows the truth, and the truth always prevails. We're going to battle, baby." Oh, God, this is just horrendous. While family members are not explicitly covered by the order, the government could ask Walton to extend it according to legal experts if they feel it compromises the case. I would assume they'll rule on this rather quickly. If I was a judge in this, I would put an end to this immediately. Although it's not going anywhere, I mean, who really cares? Who's going to be reading it? You know, it's just, you know, family members stating their opinion, trying to take Rogers back. Rogers going down with the ship, by the way. He is going to be guilty. Never mind about proving this case. The case against him is stronger than the case than they had against Barry Bonds. You know, they're calling in all kinds of ex-players that have information concerning Roger Clemens, Andy Pettit being one of them, and they used to be buddies, and that's a well-known, well-documented fact that Pettit looked up to Clemens. They trained together, all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, I don't know. this should be interesting. As I said before, this trial is going to be really interesting. I think we'll see. You know, we'll see. It's going to be a fun one to watch. Although it has been implied, it's too bad, because I thought he would be dumb enough to get on the stand. But it has been implied, I guess, during the jury selection, I guess Clemens' attorney kind of led questions to believe, you know, inquire as to whether the jurors would have any problem with Clemens not getting on the stand. You know, would that lead them to, you know, vote guilty? Because he didn't get on the stand, so I guess he's investigating, you know, he's testing the waters, we'll say, on, you know, whether Clemens should or should not get on the stand. In my mind, Clemens should definitely, absolutely, positively not get on the stand. You know, he's got a big ego, and let me tell you something, a smart prosecutor can expose that real easy. Let me tell you, real easy. Okay. Let's take a quick look back at the first half of the MLB this season. We'll start with the National League. I picked the Philadelphia Phillies in the East. They're up over the Atlanta Braves, who I said would probably come in second by 3.5 games. The Braves do have a pretty good team, but with the Phillies pitching staff, even though the Phillies aren't really hitting that much this year, I just don't see the Braves catching them. But the Braves aren't going to need to catch them. The Braves will probably get the wild card. In the Central, you know, Milwaukee's in first place, but so is St. Louis. They're both tied. That's really pretty much a garbage division, not a very strong division. Chicago's absolutely horrendous. Houston is probably the worst team in the entire league, period. Pittsburgh is much improved. You got to give it to Pittsburgh, much improved. They're 47-43. I mean, they haven't been over 500 in so long. So kudos to them and what they're trying to do down there. Out in the West, you have last year's World Series champs, San Francisco, in first place. They're up over 3 games over the Arizona Diamondbacks. I also picked San Francisco, so no surprise there. In the East, you have Boston in first place. They're up a game on the Yankees. The Red Sox have had a number of injuries, and they really didn't gel that well in the beginning of the season, although now they were hard-pressed to lose. They did lose a lot of games to the National League, which they probably shouldn't have lost. Not exactly sure why that went down. Didn't have a chance to see too many of those games. The Yankees, on the other hand, have been bitten by the injury bug all year at many different positions. Alex Rodriguez, just to be the latest, he's out for 4 to 6 weeks. He got some shoulder surgery. Now we all know why he wasn't hitting home runs. He hadn't hit one since that injury in June, I believe, 11th, when he was in Chicago. So that's your answer as to why Alex Rodriguez was not hitting for power. But he was hitting for average and doing quite well. So it'll be great for him to come back. The Yankees have, you know, fought through a lot of adverse circumstances this year. Granted, they have a very high payroll. That's true. But a lot of injuries. And I think when everything comes back together, they're going to be a stronger team for it. You see some younger guys emerging now, which is great because the Yankees have really showed in some spots that they're an older team, you know. And, you know, they do need some youth to step forward. Guys like Curtis Granderson and guys like Robert Cano got to step forward and got to pick up some of the slack. In the Central, again, much like in the National League, you have kind of a garbage division. Detroit is in first place. The big surprise there is that Minnesota is so far back. They're 6.5 back. They're 41-48, but that is due mostly to injuries. I mean, they've been decimated by injuries this year, so they're really banged up. But, you know, who knows? They might be sellers come trading time. We might be able to get a pitcher or two from them or whatever. We'll see what happens. And out in the West, you know, you have last year's American League World Series representative, the Texas Rangers, in first place, which is great. I picked them. The Angels are only a game back, which I'm very surprised because, you know, they were decimated by just losing guys through free agency and everything else. They didn't sign Carl Crawford. I mean, they didn't do a lot of things. They don't like to spend any money. They like to promote within. And, I see them falling back. But, I mean, they're only back a game. You know, anything can happen. But they're probably not going to make any significant move come trade time. So I think Texas, they don't have a problem spending money or making a move. So we'll see if they try to get better, you know, by the trade deadline at the end of this month. So here we are at the break. The All-Star game is on TV tonight. Currently the score is 0-0. The worst thing of it is that we have to listen to Tim McCarver and this other Yahoo do the broadcast. These guys are absolutely, positively the worst ever. Both of them are Yankee haters. I just can't stand this broadcast. I had the sound turned down, so I really don't even have to listen to it, which is great. Joe Buck, I'm sorry. It's Joe Buck and Tim McCarver. They're just absolutely the worst. Two big ass kissers and Yankee haters. I just absolutely horrendous. Anytime they're doing any game, whether it's a Fox Saturday game or this All-Star game, you just don't want to listen to anything they have to say. And that's all I have to say for this evening. Shout out to all my woodheads out there. Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club, my partner, Money Mike. That's it for me this week. Enjoy the hot weather because we're getting plenty of it.
Thank you, Woody. enjoyed that. I love that.
Yeah.
And this is an article from The American Dream. No more privacy. Smart meters are surveillance devices that monitor the behavior in your home every single minute of every single day. Have you heard about the new smart meters that are being installed in homes all across America? Under the guise of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and reducing energy bills, utility companies all over the United States are forcing tens of millions of American families to accept sophisticated surveillance devices in their homes. Currently, approximately 9% of all electric meters in the U.S. have been converted over to smart meters. It is being projected that by 2012, the number of smart meters in use will rise to 52 million. And the federal government is spending a lot of money to help get these installed everywhere. Eventually, the goal is to have these smart meters in all of our homes. And if that ever happened, there would essentially be no more privacy. Once installed, a smart meter monitors your home every single minute of every single day, and it transmits very sophisticated data about your personal behavior back to the utility company. So can't we just tell the utility company that we don't want these stupid things? Unfortunately, in many areas of the country, you can't. For example, one outraged resident of California contacted the utility company and was told that if he did not consent to be taking a smart meter, he would receive no service. So unless you want to live off the grid, what are you going to do? Can any of us really survive without electricity these days? The sad truth is that these things are being forced upon us. It is happening in Europe, too. The European Parliament has set a goal of having smart meters in the homes of 80% of all electricity consumers by the year 2020. Sadly, as these smart meters have gone in, there have been reports all over the country of electricity bills increasing dramatically. There have been mountains of complaints about these things, and yet their use keeps spreading. But, of course, the biggest issue with smart meters is how they will strip us of our privacy. The concern is that the incredibly detailed data that these surveillance devices collect will be given or sold to a vast array of third parties. For example, smart meters are already being used by police to bust marijuana growers. It is also feared that insurance companies, credit agencies, lawyers, marketing firms, and even criminals will be able to get their hands on the data as well. A recent article posted on the website of the Electronic Frontier Foundation summarized some of the concerns.
Without strong protections, this information can and will be reproposed by interested parties. It's not hard to imagine a divorce lawyer subpoenaing this information, an insurance company interpreting the data in a way that allows it to penalize customers, or criminals intercepting the information to plan a burglary. Marketing companies will also desperately want to access this data. For law enforcement officials, these surveillance devices are a dream come true. According to the Columbus Dispatch, police in Central Ohio have been filing at least 60 subpoenas every month for the energy use records of those that they suspect are growing pot in their homes. Well, it turns out that sometimes police are raiding homes that are using a lot of energy and they don't have any marijuana at all. Instead, sometimes these raids reveal other kinds of activities. Sometimes high electricity use doesn't lead investigators to drugs. A federal investigation in the Powell area turned into a surprise for detectives. We thought it was a major grow operation, but this guy had some kind of business involving computers. Marotta said, I don't know how many computer servers we found in his home. So you do want police raiding. So do you want police raiding your home if you start using a little bit too much electricity? Well, Jerry Day, an electronics and media expert from Burbank, California, recently detailed many of the ways that smart meters act as surveillance devices when they are installed in your homes. Number one, they individually identify electrical devices inside the home and record when they are operated, causing invasion of privacy.
Number two, they monitor household activity and occupancy in violation of rights and domestic security.
Three, they transmit wireless signals which may be intercepted by unauthorized and unknown parties. Those signals can be used to monitor behavior and occupancy, and they can be used by criminals to aid criminal activity against the occupants.
Number four, data about occupants' daily habits and activities are collected, recorded, and stored in permanent databases, which are accessed by parties not authorized or invited to know and share the private data.
And five, those with access to smart meter databases can review a permanent history of household activity, complete with calendar and time of day, metrics to gain a highly invasive and detailed view of the lives of the occupants.
Number six, those databases may be shared with or fall into the hands of criminals, blackmailers, law enforcement, private hackers of wireless transmissions, power company employees, and other unidentified parties who may act against the interests of the occupants under metered surveillance.
And seven, smart meters are, by definition, surveillance devices which violate federal and state wiretapping laws by recording and storing databases of private and personal activities and behaviors without the consent or knowledge of those people who are monitored.
Number eight, it is possible, for example, with analysis of certain smart meter data, for unauthorized and distant parties to determine medical conditions, sexual activities, physical locations of persons within the home, vacancy patterns, and personal information and habits of the occupants.
Wait a minute.
You went too far there.
No, I don't know why my down. What happens? Hang on. Okay. The time to object to these smart meters is before they go in. Once they are in all of our homes, it's going to be too late. This is all part of the radical green agenda that is being forced down the throats of people all over the world. Everything that we do has to be watched, monitored, and tightly controlled for the good of the environment. To the control freaks running things, that also means that the liberties and freedoms that we cherish so much must be greatly restricted. If you don't know about Agenda 21, you should learn about it. The UN has a plan for the future of this planet, and once you find out about this plan, you probably are not going to like it very much. And the entire globe is rapidly becoming a one big prison grid as the elite implement their vision of the future. If you want to get a really good idea of what they are planning, just watch this video.
There's a video that they have. If the control freaks get their way, there will eventually be no more privacy for any of us. Unless we speak out now, the surveillance devices are just going to become more and more sophisticated. And at some point, none of us is even going to be able to sneeze without someone knowing about it. So what do all of you think about these smart meters? Does anyone out there have a smart meter horror story? And then they ask you to leave
comments. Yeah, please feel free to comment, yeah. And there's, actually on this blog, there are 45 comments. Anyway, that's that. If you want to get to that, go to American Dream. I guess .com, it just said American Dream. Let me go back. Oh, you know what? Go back to one.
We have a few more that we want to read for you folks.
I wanted to see about the CA. We can't get it because of this.
You have to.
I need a flash player in this thing. I don't have time to install it right now.
Is that true for all the?
It looks like it. Yeah.
Yeah.
They upgraded it. Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
They upgraded the. And I have to
upgrade yours. Okay.
So.
Fluoride consumption leads to brain damage, says study. It's becoming increasingly difficult for fluoride fanatics to defend the practice of artificial water fluoridation, thanks to the plethora of new reporting highlighting its many dangers. A new study published in the Journal of Neurologia reveals that chronic exposure to and ingestion of the synthetic fluoride chemicals added to water supplies can cause serious brain and neurological damage, confirming several other recently published studies. The study further exposes the lunacy of deliberately adding toxic chemicals to the water supply in the name of saving teeth. The prolonged ingestion of fluoride may cause significant damage to health, and particularly the nervous system, writes researcher Valdez Jimenez et al. In their report. Fluoride is capable of crossing the blood-brain barrier, which may cause biochemical and functional changes in the nervous system during pregnancy, since the fluoride accumulates in the brain tissue before birth. This is a British study, I believe. And this is from Natural News. Let's see. There you have it, folks. Fluoride chemicals, which are derived from waste emitted by the aluminum and phosphate mining industries, by the way, crosses directly into the brain where they lodge themselves and cause disease. They also enter the thyroid and pineal glands and disrupt proper hormone production, which leads to various other illnesses. There simply is no denying the deadly truth about fluoride anymore. Ample evidence is continually being released that exposes fluoride as a highly toxic chemical poison. And even the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency admits that fluoride is toxic. The U.S. Center for Disease Control also initiated damage control recently by lowering its fluoridation recommendations following the release of studies that shows that fluoride harms children.
They lowered the standards. Rather than eliminated.
It's apparent that fluorides have the ability to interfere with functions of the brain. Maybe they're responsible for ADD and ADHD.
This has been in our waters since the 50s.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for 50 years, we've been dealing with this crap.
Yeah. These changes have, fluoride also increases the production of free radicals in the brain in several different biological pathways. These changes have a bearing on the possibility that fluorides act to increase the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. It is also worth mentioning that on April 12, 2010, issue of Time magazine lists fluoride as one of the top 10 common household toxins, dubbing fluoride neurotoxic and potentially tumorigenic if swallowed. It is difficult to determine how anyone can suggest that adding such a chemical to drinking water is in any way beneficial. Fluoride can be toxic by ingesting one part per million, and the effects are not immediate as it can take 20 years to become evident, as the news report. Nice.
So, I mean, all of the toothpaste and mouthwashes and just drinking water, is loaded with this crap. And they knew it. They know it, and they're still allowing it. So it's absolutely criminal what they're doing, and there's nothing we can do about it. I mean, I don't know what to do about it. You?
Just keep drawing attention to it, and people, keep writing about it, and then they'll stop.
Multi-billion-dollar terrorists and the disappearing middle class.
Oh, boy.
But there is a deep and quiet discomfort within the leading circles of the Obama regime. The best and brightest among his top officials are scampering to jump ship before the coming deluge. The economic guru Larry Summers, Rahm Emanuel, Stuart Levy, Peter Orszag, Bob Gates, Tim Geithner, and others responsible for the disastrous wars, economic catastrophes, the gross concentration of wealth, and the savaging of our living standards have walked out or have announced their retirement, leaving it to the smiling con men, President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden, and their last and clueless loyalists to take the blame when the economy tanks and our social programs are wiped out. It's by Global Research CA. The U.S. government spends $10 billion a month, or $120 billion a year, to fight an estimated 50 to 75 al-Qaeda types in Afghanistan.
Isn't that ridiculous?
Yeah, according to the CIA, and quoted in the Financial Times of London, during the last 30 months of the Obama presidency, Washington has spent $300 billion in Afghanistan and added up to $4 billion for each alleged al-Qaeda type. If we multiply this by the two dozen or so types in countries where the White House claims al-Qaeda terrorists have been spotted, we begin to understand why the U.S. budget deficit has grown astronomically to over $1.6 trillion for the current fiscal year. And during Obama's presidency, Social Security's cost of living adjustment has been frozen, resulting in a net decrease of over 8%, which is exactly the amount spent chasing this just five dozen Al-Qaeda terrorists in the mountains bordering Afghanistan.
It is absurd to believe that the Pentagon and White House would spend $10 billion a month just to hunt down a handful of terrorists ensconced in the mountains of Afghanistan. So what is the war in Afghanistan about? The answer one most frequently reads and hears is the war is really against the Taliban, a mass-based Islamic nationalist guerrilla movement with tens of thousands of activists. The Taliban, however, have never engaged in any terrorist acts against the territorial United States or its overseas presence. The Taliban have always maintained their fight was for the expulsion of foreign forces occupying Afghanistan. Hence, the Taliban is not part of any international terrorist network. If the U.S. war in Afghanistan is not about defeating terrorism, then why the massive expenditure of funds and manpower for over a decade? Several hypotheses come to mind. The first is the geopolitics of Afghanistan. The U.S. is actively establishing forward military bases surrounding and bordering on China. Secondly, U.S. bases in Afghanistan serve as a launching pad to foment dissident separatists, armed ethnic conflicts, and apply the tactics of divide and conquer against Iran, China, Russia, and Central Asia republics. Thirdly, Washington's launch of the Afghan War in 2001 and the easy initial conquest encouraged the Pentagon to believe that a low-cost, easy military victory was at hand, one that could enhance the image of the U.S. as an invincible power capable of imposing its rule anywhere in the world, unlike the disastrous experience of the U.S. of the USSR. Fourthly, the early success of the Afghan War was seen as a prelude to the launching of a sequence of successful wars, first against Iraq and to be followed by Iran, Syria, and beyond. These would serve the triple purpose of enhancing Israeli regional power, controlling strategic oil resources, and enlarging the arc of U.S. military bases from South and Central Asia through the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean.
The strategic policies formulated by the militarists and Zionists in the Bush and Obama administrations assumed that guns, money, force, and bribes could build stable satellite states firmly within the orbit of post-Soviet U.S. empire. Afghanistan is seen as an easy first conquest, the initial step to sequential wars. Each victory, it was assumed, would undermine domestic and allied European opposition. The initial cost of the imperial war, the neocons claimed, would be paid for by the wealth extracted from the conquered countries, especially from the oil-producing regions. The rapid U.S. defeat of the Taliban government confirmed the belief of the military strategists that backward, likely armed Islamic people were no match for the U.S. powerhouse and its astute leaders. Wrong assumptions, mistaken strategies, and the trillion-dollar disaster. And every assumption formulated by these civilian strategists and their military counterparts have been proven wrong. Al-Qaeda was and is a marginal adversary, the real force capable of sustaining a prolonged people's war against an imperial occupier, inflicting heavy casualties, undermining any local puppet regime, and accumulating mass support is the Taliban and related nationalist resistance movements. Israeli-influenced U.S. think tanks, experts and advisors who portrayed the Islamic adversaries as inept, ineffective, and cowardly totally misread the Afghan resistance. And blinded by ideological antipathy, these high-ranking advisors and White House Pentagon civilian office holders failed to recognize the tactical and strategic, political and military acumen of the top and middle-level Islamist national leaders and their tremendous reserve of mass support in neighboring Pakistan and beyond. And the Obama White House, heavily dependent on Islamophobic pro-Israel experts, further isolated the U.S. troops and alienated the Afghan population by tripling the number of troops further establishing the credentials of the Taliban as the authentic alternative to a foreign occupation.
As for the neoconservative pipe dreams of successful sequential wars cooked up by the likes of Paul Wolfowitz,
Abram et al.
To eliminate Israel's adversaries and turn the Persian Gulf into a Hebrew lake, the prolonged wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan has in fact strengthened Iran's regional influence, turned the entire Pakistani people against the U.S., and strengthened mass movements against U.S. clients throughout the Middle East. Sequential imperial defeats have resulted in a massive hemorrhage of the U.S. Treasury rather than the promised flood of oil wealth from tributary clients. According to a recent scholarly study, the military cost of the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan have exceeded $3.2 trillion.
And it's growing since 2001. Yeah.
And it's growing over $10 billion a month. Meanwhile, the Taliban tightens its psychological grip on Afghanistan. According to the latest reports, even the most guarded five-star hotel in the center of Kabul, the Intercontinental, was vulnerable to a sustained assault and taken over by militants because high-security Afghan forces are infiltrated and the Taliban operates everywhere, having established shadow governments in most cities, towns, and villages.
Imperial
decline, empty treasury, and the specter of a smash-up. The crumbling empire has depleted the U.S. Treasury. As the Congress and White House fight over raising the debt ceiling, the cost of war aggressively erodes any possibility of maintaining stable living standards for the American middle and working class and heightens growing inequalities between the top 1% and the rest of the American people. Imperial wars are based on the pillage of the U.S. Treasury. The imperial state has, via extraordinary tax exemptions, concentrated wealth in the hands of the super rich, while the middle and working classes have been pushed downward as only low-paid jobs are available. In 1974, the top 1% of U.S. individuals accounted for 8% of the total national income. But as of 2008, they earned 18% of the national income. And most of this 18% is concentrated in the hands of a tiny super-rich 1% of that 1%, or 0.01% of the national population. While the super-rich plunder the treasury and intensify the exploitation of labor, the number of middle-class jobs is plunging. From 1993 to 1996, to 2006, over 7% of the middle-class income jobs disappeared. While inequalities may be rising throughout the world, the U.S. now has the greatest inequalities among all leading capitalist countries. The burden of sustaining a declining empire with its monstrous growth in military spending has fallen disproportionately on middle and working-class taxpayers and wage earners. The military and financial elite's pillage of the economy and treasury has set in motion a deep decline in living standards, income, and job opportunities. Between 1970 and 2009, while gross domestic product more than doubled, U.S. median pay stagnated in real terms. If we factor in the added fixed costs of pension, health, education, real income for wage and salary workers, especially since the 1990s, has been declining sharply. Even greater blows are to come in the second half of 2011. As the Obama White House expands its imperial interventions in Pakistan, Libya, and Yemen, increasing military and police state spending, Obama is set to reach budgetary agreements with the far-right Republicans, which will savage government health programs like Medicare and Medicaid, as well as Social Security and the National Retirement Program. Prolonged wars have pushed the budget to the breaking point, while the deficit undermines any capacity to revive the economy as it heads toward a repeat recession. The entire political establishment is bizarrely oblivious to the fact that their multi-hundred-billion-dollar pursuit of an estimated 50 to 75 phantom al-Qaeda terrorists in Afghanistan has hastened the disappearance of middle-class jobs in the U.S. The entire political spectrum has turned decisively to the right and the far right. The debate between Democrats and Republicans is over whether to slash $4 trillion or more from the last remnants of our country's social programs. The Democrats and the far right are united as they pursue multiple wars while currying favor and funds from the upper 0.01% super-rich financial and the real estate moguls whose wealth has grown so dramatically during the crisis.
The conclusion. But there is a deep and quiet discomfort within the leading circles of the Obama regime. The best and brightest among this top officials are scampering to jump ship before the coming deluge. The economic... I just read this.
They're all leaving.
And they're eager to hide from the future judgment over which policymakers and leaders and what policies led to the destruction of the American middle working classes and their good jobs, stable pensions, Social Security, and decent health care, and a respected place in the world. It's a sick freaking joke is what's happening. And I'm quite scared, actually, that this is what's going to happen. I'm quite frightened by this. But anyway, let's see.
We just have about 3 minutes.
Yeah, we only got 3 minutes. Let's see if we get any kind of...
Read something positive. I'm
trying to find something. Let me see.
I like the thing on Mass Love that you can tune in at like 9:30 if we all consciously... David Icke. Go back to that and you can find it.
Mass Love?
Hmm.
Mass Love.
Oh, you didn't see that? We all, at 9:30, Britain's time, people concentrate on loving one another, and good thought.
I don't know. Okay. I don't know. They're talking about, rather than that, last minute here, I'll just say, claim Elenin is an extinction-level event. Lately, there has been a lot of talk about Elenin and the upcoming disaster which will strike Earth, not to mention the crazy weather we have been having, earthquakes, flooding, and volcanoes.
Well, that's not uplifting.
I know. But below, I'm going to include some undesirable and undeniable evidence about a pending global meltdown and the end of the world as we know it. Read our other posts, according to this.
Who's that from?
I don't know. Maybe more.
Is that Niburo they're talking about?
U.S. Hitman. USAHitman.com.
Hmm. Alignments can... Oh, because the alignment of the planets, Jupiter is aligned
right
with Mars.
Right. Okay. NASA memo, family preparedness plan, magnetic pole shift.
Go down here.
Extreme, yeah, okay.
Oh, they're talking about alignments can cause earthquakes.
Yeah.
Oh, comet. It's a comet.
It's a comet, yeah.
I didn't realize that.
It's coming. I demonstrated empirically... That's a little too...
Yeah, this is
technical.
This is all pretty technical stuff.
Yeah, they go into...
But apparently, when you have things happening in the universe, it affects the planets, the comets or the aligning of the planets. It affects us, and, you know...
Well, space shuttle
affects
mission...
Affects our weather.
The final shuttle, I don't know. But you might want to go to this site. It's an interesting site. And USAHitman.com.
And you can find out more about the comet and what a comet coming near to the planet can cause. Apparently, it has effects on, like, earthquakes and all kinds of things.
But that's it for tonight's show. And we want to thank all of our guests, Gil Townsend and Woody. And we want to thank everybody who joined us tonight. And we're going to ask that you join us tomorrow night, right here, same time, same place. And we will We will be bringing you more news and views and exciting stuff.
Well, thanks for being with us, and good night.